Hi, film fans and music fans. That's what this podcast is all about, being a fan of music and a fan of film and having a chat about it. Well, I chat about it with someone else who knows more about it than I do. Thanks to everybody who got in touch and entered our Fablemans competition. It's the first time we've done anything like that. And we had an unbelievable response. So thank you very much to everybody who got in touch and gave us your answer to the question, which was, what was the name of the film that Steven Spielberg and John Williams first worked together on and in what year? And the answer was Sugarland Express, and the film was released in 1974. So congratulations to everybody who got that right, and in particular, congratulations to Daphne, who is off to watch an exclusive pre-release screening of The Fablemans in London Town on the 19th of January. Apologies to everybody else who entered. We'll try and run some more competitions and give you the chance to get along to some super duper fancy pants screenings. But yeah, that was fun. I really appreciate you taking the time to get in touch and and enter. Nice one. Now, we've got an incredible run of guests coming up over the next fortnight. So much so, we're going to be doing a couple of bonus episodes. But what a treat we have to kick off with today. Slightly giddy and proper pinch me moment to announce this. Cate Blanchett is, well, she's just magnificent in everything she does, but she's particularly awesome in Todd Field's new film, Tar, which charts the downfall of the eponymous composer and conductor, Lydia Tár. Now, I'm not going to say too much more about it, except for the fact that Cate has real musical chops and puts her heart and soul into her incredible performance, which has already bagged her quite a lot of nominations and a couple of awards already, including a Golden Globe. And Tár is scored by the fabulous Hilda Gudnadottir. And it's with one of Hilda's cues that we'll begin the vocal version of For Petra. It's a real treat to get to talk to you, and particularly about this film when it comes to music. Before we dive into music, though, I mean, congratulations. What an incredible film. I felt like I was watching a kind of fly on the wall, really, with a beautiful character study of someone.
Yeah, that's exactly the... Todd has the utmost respect for all of the people that he collaborates with. You know, his screenplay was a conversational gambit. And so he didn't give a lot of directives, but we rehearsed a lot. But the one thing he did say is, I want it to feel like a fly on the wall. I want, because the character, a lot of the characters, not just the character I play, Lydia Tár, they're hidden from themselves. And often we do and say things gesturally or physically, or we'll use a particular word and we're not aware that we're doing it. And so the filmmaking was really twinned with that internal psychological state that the character was in.
Where did you start with your prep for her? Because there are so many levels that you must have been prepared to step into.
First, after reading the script, I jumped in and took a very cold shower to try and stop my panic.
It's the best thing.
Because I'd already said, I always wanted to work with Todd. We'd almost worked together a decade ago and that didn't happen. So I knew before I read the script that I was going to do it. And then reading the script, I I literally, thank goodness, had the 26 volumes of the Oxford English Dictionary. I thought, I have so much to learn. But by halfway through the script, I realized that that wasn't the point.
Yeah.
And the audience doesn't need to know anything about the classical music world because it's a meditation on power. But it was very, very important that the audience understood that the character had knew that Lydia had the unassailable right to stand on that podium, that she had an incredible gift. So there were certain things I just had to get on top of, like, you know, I said to Todd in pre-production, I said, look, she's been the principal conductor of this unnamed German orchestra for 7 years. She's not going to rehearse in English. She has to rehearse in German. So it was that. It was the piano. It was the conducting. No one wants to see my homework. But I had to get on top of that stuff and pretty quickly.
Well, I think that's one of the many brilliant things is that you watch it and you kind of you believe you immediately. You kind of can't see any of that prep because you live in it as a viewer.
Oh, phew.
It is in that performance that you give on that podium. What was it like for you to be on that podium for the first time and feel that physical wave of what the orchestra were giving back to you?
That is exactly it. It's a physical wave. I mean, a friend of mine, Natalie Murray-Beale, who's a wonderful conductor, and because we were shooting and preparing during the pandemic, she had time. So I worked with her and we went through all of the Mahler's Fifth. We got various different versions of the score because, you know, there'd been omissions and additions. And we chose together with Todd the sections that she'd rehearse. And I really wanted each of those sections to show a different energetic dynamic. So through that preparation and selection, I got to know the score quite well because it was important for me that I stood up there and I knew exactly what bar I was returning to. Todd gave me the score and he wanted me to do the markings so, you know, obviously I leaned on Natalie very heavily with that, but I learned so much about the visceral nature of it. You often see conductors and you think, well, they're not doing much, but
they're
yet they're sweating.
Out of time.
And they're out of time. And, you know, we see their backs and they're contrapuntal because, of course, they're always a step ahead. And so they're master musicians. Mm. And the sadness, I think, and difficulty, I think, with female conductors not having had the opportunity until relatively recently to be as celebrated as they are, and there are so many master female conductors, is that the instrument is the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't stand up on the podium, they don't get to practice their art. But the other thing that was fascinating to me was with this powerful music, this Mahler that we had to rehearse in the film, is that, of course, you prepare in silence. You don't listen to other people's recordings. I did that as a layperson initially. But then you prepare in silence. So having prepared in silence and with my character having such an acute sensitivity to sound, to noise, she's got misophonia, to stand up and give the downbeat and have that sound come back from the Dresden Philharmonie was unforgettable. I mean, I'll go to the grave with those vibrations. It was such a privilege.
And so emotional, isn't it? I had the privilege of being on stage at the Royal Festival Hall to introduce an orchestra who were doing a night of music from film. And I had to kind of tuck myself in between the kind of the string section and kind of crouch down on the stage on a seat. And I was weeping throughout the performance because it was almost like it was a magic carpet of music in a way.
Yes.
You couldn't control how you would react to it in a way. It was extraordinary.
And something that I did understand, because I'm very slow and I was hoping we'd get to do all of the concert stuff towards the end, but it was the first thing we did.
No way,
but it
wow.
was a gift in a way because I realized what the character had to lose. And that I also understood, and maybe it's something I understood from many years on stage, is that Lydia, like all of those, like all great musicians, like all musicians, no matter what their stripe, is that you through music you can try and transcend the corporeal and commune with the spiritual, and that for that to be taken away from her, and also to enter the film having not been able to play that music throughout the course of the pandemic, there's a very particular pressure brought to bear, and she risks losing a profound part of her soul.
Wow. You know? I love how the film starts as well with that interview. It's really clever.
Yeah.
It's and to play that was, it's extraordinary to watch, you know, in terms of when I was talking about fly on the wall thing, you kind of, you know, we know you're Kate Blanchett, but you're not in this film. It's kind of, in that interview in particular, you're kind of, you embody her, and it's extraordinary to watch, and you really learn so much about, it's a really great way of learning bits about the character, but you see the walls crumble as the film goes almost as a way, which is really interesting.
And look, I understand, you know, sometimes I, you know, and I'm not there in any way. Like I get stopped in the supermarket and say, didn't I go to school with you? It's not like I'm recognized or, you know, or particularly famous in that way. I'm not Lady Gaga, you know, who's an amazing musician. Talk about amazing musicians. But I did understand the thing of like, oh gosh, do I have to play Kate Blanchett today? And she plays Lydia Tarr. And then, of course, you understand, but I don't want to do spoiler alert, that her persona is constructed. And for women, and also for men, but even more so for women, in order to earn the right to play those great works, you have to have be mentored or have a line of connection back to the source. And because of her own upbringing, she had to invent that line, because she knew that she had the capacity, but she didn't have the access. And so I found that really human and quite a poignant side of the character, which of course, because of Todd's incredible ability to access nuance and complexity as a filmmaker, none of that is overt. They're just all textures, you know, in the film.
And his choices of Hildegard Knutier as well for the score.
How lucky were we? Because, I mean, Hilda's work as a composer, and speaking to her about the process of composing, because of course the character I play is not only trying to complete the box set of Mahler's Fifth and something that no other conductor has done with the same orchestra, and she's trying to complete a composition which is overdue, and so she's feeling she's failing as a composer, and she's also stuck. She's got the equivalent of writer's block as a conductor, and then in walks a muse who is young, talented, and she sees herself at the beginning of her career and wants some of that energy because she's lost her way.
And just so happens to play the cello as
Yes, I know, the heart instrument. But Hilda's music was absolutely essential. And, you know, if I'd had a very stressful day, I would come home and noodle over it at the piano. It's really haunting.
She was brought on quite early in the process as well, which I imagine was incredibly helpful to have, you know, with the seeds of that piece that you talk about, that composition that you talk about. But also, did she write, were there much kind of suites from the score that were around in terms of whilst you were shooting and things like that?
Yes, Todd and Hilda and I sat around and talked quite a lot about what that composition would be.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's obviously, the character is quite she's struggling with what she's writing. Mm. And so it's very bold of Hilda to take on that role. But it's also the absence of the score, what Hilda took out. Because often we think about great scoring for movies is when we can hear it all.
Yeah.
Great costume designs when we can see it all, when we can see the lighting. And that Todd kept weeding everything back. It was almost like a haiku.
Yeah.
And I think it was an incredible process to go through and watch Hilda shift and change that composition according to the aesthetic, the overriding aesthetic that Todd had for the film.
Sometimes silence can be more powerful than anything else.
It's the absence of sound. I mean, it's like if you can hear like a high-pitched mechanical noise when you're going to sleep, and then suddenly it goes, and you're there's an energetic shift. It's often not till that noise stops that we perceive that the noise was there at all. And there are many. The sound design in this film is extraordinary. It's imperceptible. It's almost like a dog whistle. but when the sound drops out, you really feel it, and you don't quite know why. It's a magic trick. I think he's done it. He's made as a filmmaker.
Do you use music much in preparation for characters? Is it something you reach out to?
I do. I'm a bowerbird. You never know where the moment of connection is going to come. Sometimes it's from a line that a character says, but definitely music, because it transcends. It's such an obvious thing to say, but it transcends language,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes the connections you make with the character are. From a different part of your cerebral cortex. It's not always going to be language front and center, which is ironic given how top heavy the film is with language at the beginning of the film. And of course, it moves more and more and more into the abstract and existential as the film goes on and becomes increasingly silent. But, the score was very important to me. And, and there are so many pieces of music referenced. So The Rite of Spring was a big one I listened to. And I did this thing I'd never done before, where I'd heard an interview with Simon Rattle where he said he always had music in his head as a boy, and he realized that wasn't what everyone else experienced. So I knew the character was very distracted. And I often get very distracted when I'm in the middle of creating something and I see everything through the prism of what I'm actually working on, which is a gift, but it's also a curse. So I had an earwig in my ear, always listening to music. And a lot of the time it was either Buddhist chants because, you know, and the music of the Shipibo Kanibo people, because my character had been very influenced. She was an ethnomusicologist and... but it was also Goretzky, and so there was a particular piece which we called the Tar March, which Hilda and Todd turned me on to.
So you didn't find that distracting in any way?
It was distracting.
That's what you wanted.
Very distracting.
Yeah.
But then there'd be days where I went, no, she's in silence.
Okay.
And the panic.
Wow.
That as a musician, when you can't hear music,
mm-hmm.
the panic that induces. So it was just, I mean, you know, it's, I don't know how interesting or uninteresting that is to anybody else, but it's just an interesting thing for experiment for
Absolutely.
Me to try.
When you're starting to create a playlist, though, for a character, whether it's this film or other films, what's the starting point of deciding what songs are going to go on that playlist?
It's often really random. Little Darling, because that's something that became Sharon's and played by Nina Hoss, Lydia's partner in all things, and Lydia danced to 60 beats a minute. That was definitely on there. There was a lot of Gorecki, and there was a lot of chanting, and you know, those the people who were able to split their voice into
the throat singers.
So there was quite a bit of that.
Wow.
Yeah, but there was a lot of Hilda's own work and the score, and there was, you know, there was a fair healthy dose of Nick Cave in there as well.
Yes. I love that. Hilda's kind of the whole idea. I was lucky enough, we were lucky enough to have Hilda on the podcast when around Joker time, talk about that
fantastic
score. And just hearing her talk about her process but the idea as well that this cello and the idea that's so physical, you know, and the way that you hold it and how intimate it is when you're playing it, and that's how she creates. And you can understand how her scores connect so well because they're flowing, really. You know, when you think about it, it's almost like an extension of her body in a way, the way that she holds that instrument to create. It's beautiful.
Yes. And then when she was, I said, can you just put down the line of the score, just so I can start to get the overarching theme into my head. And she sung it for me. And it's also, you know, because obviously the cello is so connected to the heart and the voice.
Yeah.
And that was extraordinary.
Oh, wow.
She's a rock star.
Yeah.
She and Todd made a music video together recently where he has her smash the cello.
No way.
And she goes, I can't smash my cello. I can't smash it. He said, don't worry, we'll get a really cheap one in. But, you know, but she went for it. She is such a rock star and an elf.
Yeah, there's something about the Icelandic culture, isn't there, that it's kind of, it's hard to describe, but there's something absolutely magical about it, I think.
And she has every time she laughs, I just laugh. She's a really magnetic, hypnotic person. But there were so many amazing collaborators on this. And, you know, Bina Diagolo did the costumes. We'd work together. It's, you know, she created wardrobes for all of us that were really enabled, because there are a lot of long days in the film that enabled us to sort of break down and show the psychological states of the characters.
Yeah.
And Marco Britner-Rosso, the production design, you know, the choice of Lydia and Sharon's apartment, which was an acoustic nightmare and was so unexpected, but was such an amazing offer, you know. And in the middle of it is this beautiful, beautiful concert grand piano that never gets played. It's like a coffin.
Mm. Do you play?
I played piano as a girl. And I've said with every subsequent pregnancy that I would pick it back up. But of course, when Todd called about this, I went, shit, I should have done it years ago. But, you know, it's a terrible indictment on me is that I don't tend to pick up these things until I'm forced to by my work. That's why I have to keep working. Otherwise, I'd just be a couch potato. But it's that's something I don't want to give up. It's having music come back into my life has been really,
that's
really
beautiful.
Special.
That's so gorgeous. Because with scores and with, for you as a film fan, are there particular scores or seeing films where the music has particularly resonated with you and you've appreciated the importance of that relationship between film and music and what it can do?
Sometimes it's sound, and I think music can be sound and can be absence of sound. I mean, I think of of Kieslowski's film and his connection with Brezhnev, you know, that those scores have been, you know, in my 20s were really powerful and influential, and I would listen to them as points of inspiration. And, you know, with the Adagietto, it's been so associated with Death in Venice.
Yeah,
and
of course.
So, you know, and I think I say that, I threw that into the rehearsal, Vergessensi, Death in Venice, you know, it's a Vergessensi Visconti, you know, because it's associated with another type of film. And how do you then disconnect those masterworks of classical music from their filmic incarnations? Vergessen Sie Visconti, okay? So familiar to everyone here, it really doesn't help you to know this piece so well. Okay.
Is that sometimes where a piece of music can have such a strong connection with a film that it's quite hard to cut those ties sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, Arvo Pärt, for instance, it's his work is extraordinary and I listen to it all the time, but often it gets overused. His work is so powerful, it can be used as a band-aid to try and place the emotion and soul onto a scene that doesn't actually have it in and of itself.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about what Todd has done as a filmmaker, is it's not overscored.
Yeah.
Because all of that music, he's a musician himself. He's a disgusting, revolting Renaissance man. You know, he can build a barn, he can play the trombone, he's an actor, he can do everything. I hate him. But he has imbued those musical rhythms into the scenes, into the way the characters walk, into the tempo, into the cutting rhythm. We had Monica Willey as our collaborator in the editor room, which is so blessed, that he then doesn't need to overscore it.
Yeah.
And so he and Hilda have been very judicious about when that's used. It's a very bold move, I think.
I could chat to you for hours about it. It's lovely to hear how musical you are.
I appreciate
it. You understand it. I'm not taught, you know, I like to.
Do you play?
No, I feel.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And so that's where this comes from, you know. So.
The heartbeat. It's one of the best instruments around the heart.
Thank you for your time. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks.
From the score to Tar, that's Tar Largo, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the fabulous Kate Blanchett. My huge thanks to Kate for taking the time to talk to us. Tar is on general release now and is utterly, utterly fabulous. If you want to hear my chat with Hilda, head to edithbowman.com where you can find every single episode of this podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and our YouTube channel is brimming with videos of the original interviews I did and lots of other goodies too. Next up, as promised, we've got a bonus episode which features not one but two guests. Friend of the pod, Justin Hurwitz, joins me to discuss his award-winning score for Babylon. And we're also joined by the film's writer and director, the wonderful Damien Chazelle. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.